This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the podcast this morning, trust in politics. How much you expect politicians to tell you exactly what's going on behind the scenes. This story about the DUP and what they did in the past. The budget coming up, of course. By the time you've listened to this, Rachel Reeves might have got on her feet and told us all how she's going to tax us. A story that was developing while we were on air around Forestside Shopping Centre and all of the calls that come to the biggest show in the country. Hope you enjoy this edition of The Nolan Show.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. Trust in politics. Trust in politicians. It's the bare minimum you're entitled to when you place your vote, your valuable vote, with a political party. This morning, Sir Reg Empey has come on the Nolan Show. You'll hear from him in a moment or two, calling on the new DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, to apologise on behalf of his party for the lies, Sir Reg Empey says, the DUP told all of you in the early 2000s. Officially, the DUP has always maintained it never sat down with Sinn Féin until Ian Paisley and Gerry Adams met at Stormont in March 2007. That's shortly before the parties entered power sharing. But we now know that people within the DUP were sitting down with Sinn Féin, talking to them well before that. Now, is that realpolitik? Is it realpolitik that they'll say one thing to your face and do another behind your back? Are they testing the waters for negotiations? If they were, why didn't they tell you? The context of this, for those of you who have forgotten, is the DUP were publicly lambasting the Ulster Unionist Party for talking to Sinn Féin. They were saying that they would not do it. And yet they were doing it themselves behind the scenes. Speaking to William Crawley on Talkback yesterday, the DUP MP Sammy Wilson was asked if he could confirm he attended some of those meetings.
I did, yes. And I was never ever asked whether I took part in those meetings or not. So I never involved myself in any denial. But I think that anybody who has observed negotiations, not just in Northern Ireland over the years, but it's always clear that before you come to the final part of negotiations, of course, both sides try to find out what are the limits? What are the things that people are prepared to accept? What are the things they're prepared to do? And that was the exercise that I would have been involved in. There was no negotiations. It was simply people wanted to know, look, what you're saying publicly, you're prepared to go into government if guns are given up and if the police are accepted. Do you really mean it? And we're looking, and equally from our point of view, look, make it quite clear to Sinn Féin that we are not sitting in government with you while you're engaged in terrorist activity, while you've got a terrorist action.
The difficulty, of course, is that the party's official position is that those meetings were not happening and that they would have been inappropriate. In fact, some journalists were warned off with the threat of legal action if they were to report that they were taking place.
And because the party's official position was that those there were to be no talks with Sinn Féin.
And yet there were.
Well, that did not stop. I mean, let me tell you this. You know, during that period when we had people in Stormont, I was sitting in Belfast City Council. Do you really think that conversations did not go on between individuals to assess whether or not there was any real intent on the other side to come to an agreement? Those conversations happen in lots of different ways.
But when Geoffrey Donaldson was sitting in Harold Good's living room having tea and scones with Martin McGuinness, at the point when the DUP was criticising the Ulster Unionists and others for engaging with Sinn Féin and saying this party won't be doing it until Sinn Féin moves on X, Y and Z, your party was effectively lying to the public, wasn't it?
We weren't lying to the public. The party had an official position. Individuals within the party, and I was one of them, individuals within the party took opportunities where there were to try and get intelligence, which could feedback, so that people were in a position to know whether or not there was business to be done. And, you know, you know as well as I do, William, that negotiations don't happen. That one day you waken up, you say, "I'm going to go into a room with the other side. I'm going to do a deal with them and come out in a couple of days' time with that deal."
But this went on for years. This went on for years with Geoffrey Donaldson.
That is
for years. The party was saying one thing in public and doing another in private.
You sought to find out from whatever channels you had whether or not there was any real business to be done.
And that might be a good thing to do, but you don't have to lie to the public while you're doing it.
We didn't, because the official party position was that we would not enter into negotiations with Sinn Féin while certain things persisted. And that was right. These were not negotiations. We were talking to them.
These were talks.
I was certain, because I was fairly junior in the party.
They were secret talks, and they were kept secret. They were kept secret for a reason, weren't they?
I was certainly not in the position to negotiate with anybody, but I was able to bring intelligence back that would have been useful in making decisions within the party.
Do you think that you and your party owe the unionist people of Northern Ireland, or all of Northern Ireland, an apology for saying one thing in public and doing the opposite in private?
No, I don't, because we didn't lie to them. We have an official position that the party officially did not engage itself in negotiations with Sinn Féin. We made it quite clear we wouldn't do until certain
conditions were met.
Now, this is the same party. That interview with William Crawley on Talkback, this is the same party which, as you know, over recent weeks has been accusing Sinn Féin of doublespeak, has been accusing Sinn Féin of not providing clarity, has been saying that Sinn Féin need to hand over more and more and more answers over the whole McMonagall affair and child safeguarding. So now we look at the DUP this morning, and this is not just about the past. This is not. Some people are making a mistake to say, well, look, this is back then. Why are you going over this now? This is a question, a contemporary question, for the new leader of the DUP, Gavin Robinson. Does he feel that it was right for his party to have acted like that in the past? Who knew what when? Sammy Wilson telling Crawley that he was a junior member of the DUP then. So did any senior members of the DUP beyond Sir Geoffrey Donaldson? Did anybody else meet? And while the DUP were telling all of you no negotiations would take place, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson was sitting in Harold Good's house with Martin McGuinness. So to Gavin Robinson this morning, this is about people being able to trust politicians and politics and political parties in this country. William's in Lisburn. Good morning, William. Your first call of the day, then we'll hear from Sir Reg MP, who is calling for Gavin Robinson to issue a public apology on behalf of his party. Go ahead, William.
Well, good morning, Stephen. I think, Stephen, the first thing is no one's surprised within unionism. The voters aren't certainly surprised with the lack of trust within all the unionist parties. And Sammy Wilson's coming out, and I know you're being very politically astute, but he's telling blatant lies.
Well, Sammy would absolutely categorically deny that, and he would say he was in talks, not negotiations.
But then he's a politician. Politicians lie for a living, Stephen.
We can't let you say that, William. We can't let you say that. Sammy Wilson is saying that he was in talks, not negotiations. He's also made it clear that he was never asked, so therefore he didn't answer the question as to who he was meeting. Now, how do you generally, so let's distance this from Sammy Wilson, do you trust politicians and political parties in Northern Ireland?
No, and the voters don't either. And as a unionist, where was the 7 tests of the DUP of the protocol ripped up? Where was the joint declaration between the DUP, Ulster Unionist Party, TUV and PUP? Ripped up and forgot about within weeks. I said to your researcher, if there was an election in the morning, unionism would be decimated because people are fed up with our leadership. It is so weak and corruptible. And I would say this to you, Stephen. What hat was Sammy Wilson wearing when he went in to meet Sinn Féin? What hat was he wearing? Would he not have known? And I said to your researcher, we wouldn't even know about this if the Methodist moderator, sorry, the president of the Methodist Church hadn't brought a book out. We wouldn't even know about this. It is corruption at the highest level.
Well,
they're telling our people they elected nothing but lies and false promises, Stephen.
William,
and
thank you.
And that is why unionism is so decimated this morning.
Good morning to you. Good morning. Remember, there is no allegation of corruption on the part of Sammy Wilson. No allegation whatsoever. It would be crazy to even suggest so. Sammy Wilson is saying, yes, he sat down and talked with the party at the time when he knew the party was saying that they would not negotiate. And Sammy is distinguishing between talking as a junior member of the DUP at the time with Sinn Féin than negotiating. Sir Reg MP, senior member, obviously, of the Ulster Unionist Party for many, many years, active in politics here in Northern Ireland, is disgusted by what he has observed.
I have no issue with Sammy Wilson meeting up with Sinn Féin. The issue I have is the fact that he's trying to make a distinction between talking and scoping issues with Sinn Féin and negotiating with Sinn Féin. And it's the fact that his party lied about the fact that they were doing this.
Well,
that's
he said they didn't lie. He said he was never asked, therefore he never answered. He didn't lie.
His party put out statements, and they had an election manifesto, which they all stood on, which said they wouldn't be negotiating with representatives of terror organisations, as they put it. So everybody who stood on that manifesto, either if they knew these talks were going on, they allowed that lie to be perpetuated to the public. And if they didn't, then fair enough, they can come out now and say that they didn't know. And in fact, I would suggest you, Stephen, or what, our leading journalist, who else knew? Did Peter Robinson know? Did Arlene Foster know? Did Lord Dodds, Lord Morrow, Lord McRae?
Well, you just can't speculate about who knew and who didn't. You've no idea those people knew.
That's what I'm saying. I'm thinking you're a leading journalist. You and your programme can ask them. And fair enough, if they didn't know, that's fine. But does anybody believe that people like Geoffrey Donaldson and Sammy Wilson were acting as independent rogues and their party behind the backs of their own party? I don't believe that.
Well, there will be many secret meetings, as you well know, Sir Reg, where individual leaders go off on their own and do what they think is right. There will be senior people within parties that don't tell their leaders what's happening. But I think it's fair enough. You're asking who else knew. It's a fair question. What type of pressure was on your party because publicly you were declaring what you were prepared to do?
Well, at the time, Stephen, it was very difficult. The abuse that David Trimble and others had to take at the time was very significant, and I believe history will be kind to him because he made a major contribution to bringing our troubles to an end. And while it's not perfect in Northern Ireland today, I thank God that there are so many people's lives who've been spared. And there is a big difference between the before and after situation of the negotiations. And many of your listeners won't remember this because of their age and so on. But those days were very difficult, and we were hounded and abused and called for everything.
And you were meeting Sinn Féin?
We were publicly, we were in the talks with them, and it was the public were fully aware that we were sitting having negotiations with them. I mean,
and meanwhile, the DUP were saying they will not meet Sinn Féin.
That is correct, and I think the issue for me, Stephen, is to say not that they were talking to them. The issue was that it was effectively deceiving the electorate into believing that they were saying one thing and doing another. And I have to say, fast forward to this year, the same pattern has been repeated, because when the Donaldson deal came up in February of this year to restore Stormont, they said at that time, there's no border in the Irish Sea, it's all sorted out. And I sit on the Windsor, or have sat on the Windsor Framework Committee over here, and I know there's a border in the RAC. So it was another deception. And in fact, if you look, many of the same people who were involved in 2007 were involved this year. And the pattern was the same. In 2007, the DUP had seven principles that they stood on, one of which is they wouldn't negotiate with Representative Terror. And fast forward to 2024, and have seven tests. Of course, most of them not met either. So there's a pattern here, Stephen, and I'm simply saying that the issue for me is not that the fact that we're talking, the issue is that we're not being honest.
So
and
do
that
you
is
think
my big issue.
What are you asking for here? Are you asking for Gavin Robinson, the current present day leader of the DUP, to apologize for what happened back then, or what are you calling for?
Well, first of all, because again Gavin's much younger, he wouldn't have been directly involved in this. But what the question I think needs asking is, at what point did he become aware that this was happening? Because obviously the party put a statement out the other day in response to the revelations from Reverend.
But what
Goodsbrook.
Can he do about it?
Well, he can tell us when he knew, and he could, if he so wished it, tell people that he deeply regrets that his party misled the electorate. So that's something he could do, and that's something that those.
Well, he didn't personally mislead the electorate. You're talking about an apology on behalf of his party. Is that what
correct.
You're calling for?
That is correct.
What good would that do?
Well, first of all, I think you will know that many people ask for apologies for all sorts of things, whether it's mistreatment in the health service, whether it's look at the post office position, they're looking for apologies there. It sometimes at least allows people to move on and move past the situation. So it's not an unusual thing to ask for, Stephen. But look, at the end of the day, the important thing we've got to focus on is I'm glad that Storm's working. I'm glad that the political system is working, and I hope it will help, and particularly, and we're waiting on the budget later today and so on. There's so many things people need help with. But at the end of the day, politics has to be based on honesty, and you can't allow people to say one thing and do another. It just won't work. So I would hope that we can get this all out into the open, and you and your colleagues as journalists, and I, again, we're very grateful to have free journalists in this country, because I think if we hadn't, lots of stuff would never have come out in the open. And I hope and pray that we can get this out into the open and people try and rebuild some confidence in the political system, because we're all damaged by it if people don't have any faith in their political leaders.
And finally, on the broader issue of how much misinformation, how many times the public are lied to by politicians in Northern Ireland, current day, what's your assessment?
Well, I mean, most people are in politics because they believe in what they're doing and they want to improve the lot of everybody in Northern Ireland. So I think most people arrive in the political scene for the right reasons. But the system obviously does put pressures on people, and sometimes that leads to a series of people finding it's easier to tell untruths and to hide things. And I mean, we've seen in the last couple of weeks Sinn Féin's wriggling on the whole question of child protection and other issues. So it's not unique to the DUP or to any other party for that matter. But I do think it is eroding public confidence in our political system. And that's why I think it would be good to get it out into the open. So who knew what, when? It's fairly basic stuff and it shouldn't be hard. But to try and hide behind a pinhead definition of saying if you're talking to somebody, you're not negotiating with them, we're only scoping out the issues. I mean, that's just preposterous. And I would remind you, Stephen, that the talks process which the DUP walked out of was called the Mitchell talks process. It wasn't the Mitchell negotiating process.
Sir Reg MP, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are lots of calls on this morning. We're going to come back to this in a few minutes' time. 0303 80 55 55. And I think Sir Reg MP saying there, who knew what, when, is important. Excuse me, because we don't know which politicians knew that were within the DUP that their party was meeting. All we know at this stage is Sammy Wilson. That's the only person we know who knew, along with Sir Geoffrey Donaldson. Sir Geoffrey Donaldson was meeting Martin McGuinness, wasn't he? He was sitting in the house, in Harold Good's house. We know that from his book that's just been released. And we know Sammy Wilson was in talks, as he describes them, with Sinn Féin. Sammy saying, well, look, that's what you do when you're and he actually used the final part in negotiations. So I'm just curious. It's the final part of negotiations. Sammy's saying he was a junior member of the DUP, but he's saying it was the final part of negotiations. So Sammy is saying he was junior. A junior member of the DUP with not that much clout during the final part of negotiations? There are lots of questions around this, aren't there? And as I say, it's not just a question about the past. It's about today. It's about honesty in politics. It's about you being told, not dancing on the head of a pin what's going on. It's just about you being told by your political representatives, here's what we're doing, here's what we're at. So we're contacting the DUP this morning. We're putting Sir Reg Empey's question to Gavin Robinson. Does he feel he needs to apologise on behalf of the party, and who knew what when? We'll come back to this. Budget day. The Chancellor will stand up at around 12:30 today, 3 hours' time. This is Rachel Reeves delivering Labour's first budget for 14 years. What are they going to do? Well, the likes of tax on alcohol, the likes of tax on cigarettes, the likes of tax on our petrol and our diesel, inheritance tax, capital gains tax, if you've bought any shares. John Campbell, our business economics editor, will join us in just a second. The Alliance Party MLA, Owen Tennyson's got a very brief window to speak to us this morning. Owen, your thoughts on all this speculation? This is going to be a very, very difficult budget.
Well, certainly, Stephen, that's what's been telegraphed. And look, Labour came in to Parliament after the last election promising change and a departure from the austerity and the pain that had been felt by people over much of the last decade under the Conservatives. And so we want to see, and we've made representations to the Chancellor, a more progressive and fair system of taxation, but also a focus on investment in public services and in tackling issues like climate change. There are some positives. We have been advocating, for example, for a change to the fiscal rules to allow additional investment. It looks as though the Chancellor is going to take an initial step in that direction, and that is hugely significant because whilst it sounds technical, it will impact the funding that's available for investment here in Northern Ireland. But there are other issues too that we want to see addressed that are unlikely to be addressed today in terms of our funding model and the needs-based factor that's applied to the funding formula here in Northern Ireland. So there's certainly a job of work that will still have to be done post the budget today and ahead of the comprehensive spending review, which we're expecting in due course.
Do you think it's fair enough for them to continue to put taxes up on booze and cigarettes?
Well, certainly from my perspective, Stephen, I would rather see tax hikes in those areas than, for example, taxes hiked in terms of national insurance contributions. So, yes, I think there is a health argument in terms of levying taxes in places that align with the government's objectives, because that can actually have a preventative impact. If you reduce alcohol and tobacco consumption, that can actually reduce pressures elsewhere in terms of the NHS. So I think it's exactly the kind of thinking that we need to do. But we also need to ensure that we're doing that in a way that is fair and that is progressive, and that is the test.
John Campbell will set this all out for us in a minute or two where we're at. But essentially where we're at, this 700-odd million pound shortfall, and then we're likely to get 500-odd million of it back. In other words, it's going to be just over 200 million of a gap in our finances of what we're of what the departments are signalling they would like to spend, they intend to spend, and the money we've got. We heard from our finance minister yesterday, Owen, Keeva Archibald, proposals that she's setting in front of you all that wouldn't bring in anywhere close to that 200 million. Might bring in 10 million, somewhere around that. Has she gone far enough? Do you think the executive should be going further for revenue raising?
Well, Stephen, I think there are a couple of things that we need to look at, and there's an onus both on Westminster and the Assembly in this regard. So, yes, it's been well telegraphed out. We're expecting in the region of £500 million. That will bring the projected overspend for this year down to about £200-odd million. And so there's a gap there that the Executive will be expected to fill. We will continue to make the argument that Northern Ireland's funding formula doesn't actually properly reflect our need, and so there's a need for a fairer model from Westminster. So that's the first thing. The second area is that we need to look at opportunities for more efficient spend. There is a Public Service Transformation Board established at the moment, which is looking at a number of proposals which would realise savings, but those savings won't happen immediately. So there's need for negotiation around, for example, the horizon in which Treasury is considering some of these issues and allowing us more time to make the changes that are necessary. But yes, revenue raising has to be part of that conversation, and we have consistently said that we're open to revenue raising so long that as it is progressive, it is fair, and that it actually supports economic growth.
Someone that was right in the heart of the political machine until recent years was saying to me yesterday, look, the executive, their hands are tied with how much they can actually raise if they rule out water charges, and water charges would be the game changer. Should that definitely be off the table, Owen?
Well, look, there are a number of different ways to look at our water infrastructure. I don't believe an additional charge is the way to go because people are already paying for water through their rates. But there is an argument around mutualising NI Water, which effectively increases the borrowing capacity of that organisation and enables additional capital investment. But the key issue there, Stephen, is reform of that nature can't happen overnight. You're talking at least 3 years before you would be in a space to make those kinds of changes to NI Water. And so it's not realistic to expect that the executive could make those changes immediately in order to realise savings this year. And that's what government is asking us to do. They've asked us to balance our budget this year. The Assembly has just been back. We have been disrupted by stop-start government over recent years. And I think there has been an element of inertia pervading successive executives where people have refused to take the difficult decisions that are necessary. I think we need to change our attitude and approach, absolutely.
So what's the first difficult decision your party would take?
Well, the first thing that we would do, Stephen, and we've talked about this ad nauseum in previous executives and in previous manifestos, we want to see a review of the cost of division and duplication actually commissioned in order to identify those areas where we are duplicating services due to the legacy of our past and due to societal division. Because that's key not just to realising financial savings, but also enhancing our society and bringing people together and building a more reconciled and integrated community here. So that is really important to us. And we think that there is an argument across many various sectors of the public sector for us to look at how we can realise those savings. Again, we're realistic that that won't happen overnight, but there has to at least be a willingness from other parties and other ministers to look at those opportunities.
Owen, thank you very much indeed. We'll hear from John Campbell. He'll set out for us what we expect to hear in the budget in just a second. The Stephen Nolan Show! Right, our business economics editor, John Campbell, is going to be busy today. Good morning, John.
Morning.
As I have a wee stretch. Right, so the budget, 12:30 today, the Chancellor will get on her feet. What are we likely to hear in terms of taxes on our fuel that we put into our cars, for example? Taxes on people who still smoke and for those of us who still like a wee drink.
Not expecting anything on fuel taxes, to be honest. And I suppose fags and booze will go up in the way that they normally do.
Which is what? By inflation or more, or what do they usually do?
They usually just go up, you know, sometimes by inflation, sometimes more, sometimes less. But yeah, you know, generally those are on a sort of escalator, those taxes on cigarettes in particular. You know, sometimes you get occasional stuff around, you know, alcohol that we won't put up the price of a pint or whatever, but we will put up wine, that sort of thing. But generally the taxes on those things only go one way.
And Labour has been flagging, both the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, have been flagging that this is going to be a difficult budget. What does that mean for all of us, or some of us?
Well, fundamentally, the position which the Prime Minister has staked out is to say they've been left with a bit of a mess in public services. In order to try and sort out that mess, they're going to need to put money into public services, and therefore they're going to need to raise some taxes. And when it comes to raising taxes, as far as possible, they want to levy those taxes on people who own assets, or wealthier people, and they want as far as possible not to raise taxes on people whose only means of income is to go out and do a day's work. And what that is actually going to mean in practice is that the major tax they're going to increase is employers' national insurance. So that is basically a tax that employers pay, which is related to the number of people they have on their payrolls and how much they pay them. Another way in which they can raise tax is in a slightly stealthy way, which is by freezing the levels, continuing to freeze the levels at which you start to pay income tax and which you pay higher rate tax. So that means that over time, as your wages go up, if those thresholds don't move, then a larger proportion of your wages is taxed or is taxed at a higher level. But because that can be quite a difficult concept to grasp, it's a kind of stealthy way to increase your taxes. There are other areas they could look at. So,
John, just
example,
before you move on from that, yeah, sorry to cut across here.
Yeah.
So do we know the numbers of people in Northern Ireland who are currently paying 20% tax because they're not caught in that 40% tax bracket that will be pulled into it when Labour frees the amount?
We do. They're published by HMRC every year. I don't have them at my fingertips at the moment. We had actually been in a position for quite a long time where the number of people who actually paid income tax in Northern Ireland was falling as one of the previous governments kept increasing the threshold at which you started to pay income tax. With those thresholds being frozen now, the number of people paying income taxes has gone back up again. But generally, in Northern Ireland, you'll have the bulk of workers will be paying the basic rate of income tax rather than the higher rate, which kicks in at about sort of 45 grand around that area.
And we'll go off and we'll try to find those figures ourselves. Excuse me. But it'll certainly be a shock to the system for some people if they're used to paying 20% tax on the majority of their earnings. And then they're pulled into that 40% tax bracket.
Well, because I think you need to understand marginal tax rates. Is that it's not suddenly that if you go into the 40% tax bracket, all your earnings are taxed at 40%. That's not how it works.
No,
you're only taxed on the bit that goes over.
I know, but bit that goes over, for example, could be someone's propensity. So I know that. But it could be someone's propensity to do overtime, for example. And you could find yourselves, you could find some people in a situation where they say, well, I'm not going to do overtime if that bit of the overtime, if that bit of my earnings has been taxed at 40%, for example.
That's possible, but I suppose why governments like fiscal drag in this way is that probably most people don't think about it that way. You just look at your income slip, you look at your pay slip, and you think, well, is it going down or is it going up? And if it's not going down, if you aren't obviously being taxed more than you were previously, then you think, well, actually, I'm okay there. Because you know, when we're talking about this fiscal drag thing, largely it's about saying, you know, you're paying more tax than you otherwise would have if those bands had been going up. So it's a sort of thing, probably a tax which people don't notice too much, unless they sort of really start to drill into it.
You were going to go on to other tax measures.
Yeah, so employers' national insurance is the big one, and then also potentially capital gains tax, which is a tax when you pay when you sell assets. So that could be like if you own property that's not your main home, if you own a business, if you own shares which are held outside an ISA, the tax rate on those things is likely to go up.
There's been speculation, hasn't there, in quite a few of the national newspapers that what the Chancellor may do is not touch second homes because she doesn't want to disincentivise landlords. We don't know for sure, let's find out, but that she will hit people with shares.
Yeah, that's part of the speculation. Now, to be honest, this is very much a minority interest in Northern Ireland because we are a reasonably poor part of the UK. Capital gains tax is not something which will affect large numbers of people here. Same also with inheritance tax. So there's speculation that some of the loopholes in inheritance tax could be closed. Again, that's very much a minority interest in Northern Ireland. The last year for which we have data suggests that only about 300 estates a year are actually affected by inheritance tax in Northern Ireland. And without getting into the detail of it, mostly with inheritance tax, without too much planning, you can pass on about £1 million worth of assets tax free. Generally, is you know what it will amount to for most people. So again, that's pretty much a minority interest in this part of the world.
Let me double back finally to employers' national insurance, because the vast majority of people don't really know about it, but your employer pays 13.8% on some of your earnings as national insurance. And if the Chancellor puts that up, here's the question, John. Is that likely to feed through to employers saying, well, I'm going to employ fewer people? I'm going to cut wages?
I don't think... it would be cutting wages, because in this labour market, I just think employers could get away with cutting wages. They wouldn't have any staff working for them. It's a very tight labour market. But there's an interesting piece on the BBC News website at the moment. My colleague Clodagh Rice interviewing a business in Belfast City Centre, and they're talking about both the impact together of higher employers' national insurance and also higher minimum wage. And that does have an impact on those businesses thinking about, well, you know, we maybe won't hire that extra person which we were thinking of hiring. You know, we'll keep with our existing staff, and we'll have to kind of cut our cloth around that. And then the other potential impact around those employers' national insurance rise over the longer term is what it means for employee pay rises, because employers are looking at the total cost of employing somebody, and if more of that cost is going towards tax, then they will have less flexibility to pay people more. So with employers' national insurance, it can eventually have a knock-on effect through to employees, because either the company don't hire as many people or else they have less capacity to give pay rises.
And does that increase in employers' national insurance apply to the public sector or just the private sector?
My understanding is it's across the board. There's not a carve out for the public sector.
So that then means more costs automatically for the NHS, for the Department of Education employing teachers. That's an extra cost on the executive before we start, right?
Yeah, and just in terms of your previous interviewee talking about the difficulties that Stormont has and the big spending pressure that they have, a lot of that is to do with the recent public sector pay deals. You know, the biggest cost the public sector has really is staff costs, and employers' national insurance increase, and also the minimum wage increase to some extent. That will also add on to the costs incurred not just by the private sector, but also by public sector employers.
I want to ask you one final question, John, and it's this, and it's around this shortfall that we have in funding in Northern Ireland. I was listening to you on Good Morning Ulster this morning. Can't get enough of you, John. And at the end of the day, you were talking about this 700 odd million quid that we're scheduled to need to spend. By the time we get money from across the water, we're going to be left with 200 odd million of a shortfall. Is that right?
Yeah. That's basically it. And so it's not to say this is not money which will necessarily be overspent. In fact, I don't imagine there will be an overspend. This is money that departments are saying, this is money that we think we need to spend, we would like to spend, we think it's important that we spend this money, but we don't have the money to spend at the moment. So most of the shortfall, I think, will be made up by the money which comes from Westminster. But after that, basically, departments have to cut their cloth, meaning they will not be able to do some of the things which they say they need to do. So that can be, you know, potentially cutting some programmes. It can be delaying starting some projects, those sorts of things. But, you know, the Finance Minister has made very clear to all our executive colleagues, we need to live within the resources that we have. And that is going to involve some budget management and potentially some difficult decisions.
And on yesterday's programme, we were talking about, well, look, what about revenue raising? Is that how we try to cut our cloth? I want to read this text to you. I got it yesterday after the Nolan show, after we were talking, from someone at the heart of politics here who said the following. It's essentially a waste of time. Not enough people in expensive houses. He was talking about Kiva Archibald's proposals. And this person said, it's essentially a waste of time. Not enough people in expensive houses. A larger regional rate increase for everyone would make more sense and raise much more. But the fundamental problem is we get over 90% of funding from the block grant. So even big increases in local taxes have quite a limited impact on spending power. Common sense would suggest water charges with protections for the vulnerable, increase student fees, a 10% regional rate increase for all as a start. Almost anything else is tinkering at the edges.
Yeah, well, there was a big piece of work done a number of years ago now by this independent body called the Fiscal Commission, and they went through all these things looking at, you know, where extra money could be raised. And, you know, the big ones and the major levers Drummond has to pull is rates. And, you know, you could have the reform stuff we were talking about yesterday, but it's quite right. The major way which Drummond could raise additional money is just by across-the-board increase in rates. That's the only, you know, the broad enough tax base that you have where you can raise significant money. On student fees, again, you know, I don't even know how much more money that would raise for other resources, because it would depend on what you're going to do with that money. You know, would it go into the pot generally, or would you use it to expand the number of student places, in which it basically, you know, it becomes a kind of a net neutral decision. But yeah, it's fundamentally, it would be rates and water charges are the only thing which would make much of a difference. And again, I remember when we've had the discussion about devolving tax powers to Northern Ireland on a couple of times, and you know, all the experts who've looked at that say, listen, the only thing which would make a difference in terms of Stormont spending power is you would need to devolve income tax and put up the basic rate. That is the only way in which you would raise a significant amount of additional money. So I think if you're, you know, looking in the Northern Ireland context and saying, oh, well, you know, we'll be able to kind of make up the shortfall by squeezing the rich, there ain't enough rich people in Northern Ireland to make that much of a difference. You have to basically look at the broad tax base to actually raise any significant sums of money.
Did you get up this morning like it was Christmas Day? Like, is that what budget day is like for you? I often wonder about you, you know, and think to myself, like, is this all his Christmases at once? Have you eaten posters
really.
Of Rachel Reeves in your bedroom and things?
The way people, I think the good description of the budget nowadays, it's a bit like the FA Cup final. You still take an interest in it, but it's not as big as it once was. And the reason being is, you know, so much is leaked in advance. You tend to have other fiscal events during the year, so it's not the kind of the big kind of surprise that it once was.
John, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. See, there's the difference between John Campbell and I. I think of burgers and prawn cocktail crisps, and he thinks of fiscal events. Glenn Roberts, Retail MI Chief Executive. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. Well, look, we were talking about employers NIC there, and I guess, you know, I was making the point that the vast majority of the public, they don't see that, they don't care about that. What they will care about is if an increase in employers NIC results in fewer jobs.
Well, there's no doubt that this hike on national insurance will be not just a tax on jobs, but on small businesses generally. If you want, I mean, the Chancellor has said her priority is growth in the economy. And the one thing you don't do if you're serious about growth is restrict the biggest element of your economy, which is small businesses. I mean, 98% of all business in Northern Ireland is small. 89% employ less than 10 people. So this will be a hammer blow to those businesses. And let's not forget, just as John and yourself mentioned about business rates, our members are already paying the most expensive business rates anywhere in the UK by a country mile. So to add on this national insurance hike and changes with the living wage is going to be an absolute hammer blow. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about working people. The businesses that I represent, those business owners, those independent retailers, they're working people just as much as anybody else. And they're going to be hammered today. I mean, far from increasing tax on business, if the Chancellor is serious about growth, she should be reducing the tax burden on businesses to lock in that growth, to get small businesses across the board employing more people. That's the way you do it.
The reality, Glenn, is the Chancellor isn't going to be listening to you or I, but Stormont might be. So what leveraging powers does Stormont have here that could help business at the moment, given what's coming?
Well, other parts of the UK got a 75% reduction in their rates bill for independent retailers and hospitality businesses. As you and I have talked about on your show before, we didn't get that. In fact, we didn't get one penny of that in Northern Ireland. So I think that certainly the finance ministry should be very, very careful that hiking up the regional rate on business will be simply a non-starter. I mean, if we have to get focused on what do we need to do to grow our economy. You don't grow your economy by taxing business. You support business, you help business, you take some of the burden off business and encourage them to employ more people, get more people spending. So I don't think that the finance minister has a lot of room to manoeuvre. The other thing we'll be looking at today is what's happening with the city deals, the Causeway and Mid-Southwest. It's crucially important that those two city deals are able to go forward as well.
Okay, Glyn Roberts from Retail NI, thank you very much indeed. Back to our top story today, Sammy Wilson telling William Crawley on Talkback yesterday that he attended secret meetings with Sinn Féin at a time when the party were against negotiating with Sinn Féin.
For years, the party was saying one thing in public and doing another in private.
You sought to find out from whatever channels you had whether or not there was any real business to be done.
And that might be a good thing to do, but you don't have to lie to the public while you're doing it.
We didn't, because the official party position was that we would not enter into negotiations with Sinn Féin while certain things persisted.
Well, Mick Field, the editor of Slugger O'Toole. Morning to you, Mick.
Morning, Stephen.
From what I can see on the phones here, there are quite a few people who want to talk about this, and this is not just, Mick, a story of the past. It's a story of our expectation from politicians right now. What they tell us, what's it mean?
Someone who was talking to people who were quite senior, both within Sinn Féin and the DUP, around about this time, the point when, after 2002, the institutions had collapsed. There was a remarkable consistency on both sides. They both seemed to insist that they weren't talking to each other, and therefore people in the middle, like myself, were really vital in terms of scoping out what the common ground might actually be. So there was definitely intention. The public messaging was there was no talking. But there was clear intention both on the Sinn Féin side and on the DUP side to get some progress made so that at some point there could be enough contact to do a deal. So for somebody like me, you know, at the time, I couldn't write about it, but because it was, you know, it was just a surmise on my part. For someone like me, it seemed pretty obvious. They must have been talking because the message I was getting from both of them was pretty consistent, almost down to using the same kind of language.
But is the point of this story not, Mick, that while that was going on, and many people will understand that to be real politic, the DUP were hammering the Ulster Unionist Party, were they not?
No, they were. And I think that this revelation insofar, I mean, I'm wary, and I think the Reverend Good ought to really consider some of the cynical responses that have come as a result of this revelation. Nevertheless, it happened, and it's in the public domain now. I think that we have to start reevaluating the work of people like David Trimble in light of the fact that they were being attacked in public, but in private, the DUP was trying to pull off more or less the same trick as he had managed to do in public from 1998 onwards. And I think it's important to that whatever follows, whether it's an apology or whether it's a statement, that we actually understand, I think as Lord Empey pointed out, that the Northern Ireland we're living in now is 100 times better than it was before. And I'm not just talking about lives that have been saved, but the quality of life that people have in Northern Ireland is down to the kinds of public sacrifices that people like David Trimble made back in those days under extreme fire from the DUP.
And Reg Empey has said in this programme this morning that he's calling on Gavin Robinson to apologise. What's the best strategy or the likely strategy from the DUP here? To wait till the news cycle moves on, or if it's about trust in politics for Gavin to make some statement? What do you think they'll do?
I think if the DUP, look, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not a fan of apologies for things that have happened in the past. I think it's difficult to take an apology seriously from a young man like Robinson, who is a next generation politician, who wasn't, he may have been in the party, but I don't think he was a public representative at this particular moment in time. And, you know, as the old saw goes, when facts change, you change your mind, you move on. One of the problems with people getting het up about the hypocrisy of elected politicians is we need them to change their mind. We need them to be hypocritical. It's part of the whole public baggage of trying to be a representative politician. So when the public changes its mind, you have to find some elegant way of kind of moving on with that. So in a way, it's less an apology that the DUP needs to do and more an internalisation that many of the things that they attacked David Trimble for, he did honestly. He did it in public and he took the political damage for it.
Have a listen to William and Bangor. Morning, William. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak this morning. I mean, as a 41-year-old father of a young family, I was brought up to appreciate and understand the mechanics of the country and the government that we live in and actually have a bit of intelligence around it all. And with that, I was brought up in a unionist household that could understand the benefits of the union. At the time I was 18 was at the time of the Good Friday Agreement. I have no problem saying at the time I was encouraged, like other family members, to vote no. And that was purely on the basis of prisoner release. That was just a step too far for a lot of honest, decent people. And looking back, you know, it was very clear to me as I moved through years at Queen's and then into business that history was going to show a very different perception to what happened. And David Trimble, it was always going to come to light. You know, my family were what you would have called official unionists. And when I zip forward to 2024, I think when I spoke to one of your producers, the phrase I used is that unionism is terminally ill. And I can pick up just there.
So what do you make? Is it important to you what you're learning about what the DUP did or didn't do? What do you make about what they were doing in private?
It's very important, Stephen, because as a reasonable person who listens to what's put before me when making decisions as to how to vote and what's important for the country, I, as a young man, find the treatment of Trimble and Lord Trimble, we should call him that, his family, his wife, and a really top team that he had, a real top team that were trusted individuals.
How does it make you feel about the DUP?
Well, I was just coming on to that. The DUP were handed the keys to unionism in 2007, would never have been in a stronger position. And the contempt that they, and I voted for them, and I have done since, the contempt that has been shown.
What contempt? We're 40 seconds before the news. What contempt?
What contempt? I mean, the lack of leadership, the lies, the treatment publicly of the Trimble team, and the treatment publicly of the Good Friday Agreement that has delivered Northern Ireland to where it is today, which is actually somewhere you can be as children. And okay. I remember the bad days.
All right.
But the contempt from Foster, who give us all hope, to where we stand today. And I will just say we've an unelected Deputy First Minister okay. leading unionism okay. and Gavin Robinson.
We are out of time. William, thank you very much. Mick Fielty, thank you. Here's the news. The Stephen Nolan Show! Right, on the Nolan Show this morning, Sir Reg Empey from the Ulster Unionist Party has called on the new leader of the DUP, Gavin Robinson, to apologise on behalf of the DUP for the lies Sir Reg Empey says the DUP told all of you in the early 2000s. They were lambasting the Ulster Unionist Party for speaking to Sinn Féin. That's what they were publicly doing. They were officially saying that they had never sat down with Sinn Féin until Ian Paisley and Gerry Adams met at Stormont in March 2007. But what was actually happening behind the scenes, and we know this from Harold Good's new book, we know that Geoffrey Donaldson, for example, was talking to Martin McGuinness in Harold Good's home. And we now know that Sammy Wilson was also talking to Sinn Féin, Sammy distinguishing between talking to Sinn Féin at the time, having meetings when they talked, and what he was terming negotiations. Former minister within the DUP, Jim Wells, has contacted us this morning. Did you know about this, Jim?
Stephen, I didn't, and I was the secretary to the assembly group, the DUP assembly group, from 1998 to 2012. So I was in every meeting leading up to this. And in all of those meetings, Not once were we told, was there any form of contact? Now, the talks, negotiations, any form of contact. What's even worse, we were told that the party line was to lambast the Ulster Unionist Party because they were openly in contact with Sinn Féin, which we weren't. And therefore, I do actually, on this occasion, agree with Sir Reg MP. He does deserve an apology, because I remember at the time some of the statements that went out against him and the Ulster Unionists saying, there you are, you're talking, you have regular contact with Sinn Féin, we are purer than a diamond, we weren't there, we're not doing it. And that was simply totally untrue.
So when did you think the first meeting was?
Well, see, Stephen, at this stage we were all kept in the dark. Completely. We believed that the first meeting was held in March 2007, which was public, and that led to the return of devolution later on that year. And that's the first time any of us were aware, any of the backbenchers were aware that this was going on. I was also a party officer during this period as well for a short period. And again, nobody was told. And, I mean, the real power broker in the DUP is actually Timmy Johnson, who's now the chief executive. And Timmy Johnson was there. Timmy Johnson sat in all of those group meetings, as did Sammy Wilson. And never once was there any indication of any contact with Sinn Féin.
Well, we don't know that Timothy Johnson knew.
Well, according to the Reverend Good's, book that has been written, they've actually said that Timmy Johnson was there and indeed was sent out to make a phone call to Dr. Paisley to tell him what was going on. Now, we don't know whether that phone call actually took place or not, but Timmy Johnson's fingerprints are all over this, and he is still the chief executive of the DUP. And I think that's the person you need to be speaking
well,
to.
Well, we will ask Timothy Johnson. And look, Harold Good's book is one version from one individual. We will ask Timothy Johnson if he was or wasn't there, but you don't know and I don't know. What we do know is Sammy Wilson was talking to Sinn Féin. This is Sammy Wilson, who's a friend of yours for years.
Yes, but Stephen, hang on. It's not a case of people making accusations and unsubstantiated comments. Sammy Wilson has admitted to the BBC that he was there.
Correct.
And the DUP have not denied the Reverend Good's comments.
Correct.
In his biography that
is correct. So let's,
so that's true.
So let's talk about Sammy Wilson, for example. As I say, someone you've known for years. He's distinguishing between talking to people in Sinn Féin and negotiating. And he's also saying, look, nobody asked him, so therefore he never denied it because nobody asked him.
Well, Stephen, sometimes you can tell the truth in order to create a lie. And the point was that Sammy sat in all the meetings with us before he became an MP. He sat in all the meetings, and not once when this came up did he ever say, oh, hold on, but there has been contact. I've been in the same room as Martin McGuinness, and so has Timothy Johnson and Jeffrey. That was never said. The lie was, we are purer than a diamond. We never had contact with Sinn Féin. And let's lambast the Ulster Unionist Party because they've admitted they have. That's, I think, where the difficulty arises. It's one thing keeping quiet. It's another thing lambasting your opponent.
And what were the instructions about what to do with the UUP meeting Sinn Féin?
The party line was this was a weakness in the Ulster Unionist Party, that they have had contact with Sinn Féin before the decommission of weapons, and therefore the line was go out there to your meetings, your rallies, and your do press statements lambasting Ulster Unionist Party for their weakness. Now, had we known that we were doing exactly the same, I think the troops would have been a wee bit less diligent in doing that. And I must now say, I now regret comments that I made, criticising David Trimble and Reg MP, etc., when really I was basing that on totally false information.
You've fallen out with your party. You've fallen out with the DUP.
I have. So
you have an agenda.
Yes, I have left the DUP.
So you're speaking this morning with an agenda, so I'm therefore curious how much of that agenda you have against your former party is clouding, is affecting what you're saying this morning.
Well, Stephen, what I do have in my office is the minutes, the agreed minutes of every group meeting of the DUP for 12 years around this period. Those minutes were agreed at the following meeting of the party, and those state very categorically that we did not have any contact with Sinn Féin up until March 2007. Now, that was a line, and had we been told, I'm sure that somebody would have broken ranks and condemned it, but I'm absolutely certain that I've sat, and I spoke to a colleague this morning, and he's certain, we sat in those meetings, and there was absolutely no indication this was going on. And the question is, did Dr. Paisley even know? Did the party leader know this was going on, or was this done behind his back? We don't know, we may never know. But That's
well, Sammy Wilson told Crawley yesterday that what he was able to do was bring intelligence back to the party, is what he said. We'll find the exact words, but I remember what he said, that he was able to bring intelligence back to the party as to how committed, how serious Sinn Féin actually were in negotiating. Is that not real politic? And when Sammy was saying bring it back to the party, he was hardly bringing it back to the cleaner in the party.
Yeah, well, that's the question, is who knew what and when. But that still doesn't get around the statement, we've had no contact with Sinn Féin. No talks, no negotiations, nothing. And we won't until decommission has occurred and various criteria, the support of police and all the issues that arose at that time. That's one issue. But then, if you knew that was going on, why were the troops told to go out and castigate the Ulster Unionist Party because they were doing exactly the same? That's the issue I have. I remember all the speeches at the time. We were roasting the Ulster Unionist Party for what they were doing, and we were doing exactly the same.
So what are you saying? Are you saying sorry to David Turnbull and others this morning,
well,
Reg MP?
Well, I'll have to go back and look at various speeches I made at the time, but I would be saying to I can't, unfortunately, David's no longer with us, but to Reg, if I've castigated
but
the...
But you can publicly say you regret what happened to David Turnbull. That's what
Absolutely.
I meant by that.
Absolutely.
On and this are issue, you sorry?
I am. On this issue, now, I mean, there were other issues where we disagreed with David, and I think we had very sound reasons for doing so, and with Sir Reg. But on this occasion, yes, I am sorry that if I was out there castigating the Ulster Unionist Party for being in talks when I unwittingly was unaware that we were doing exactly the same, that is totally, that's immoral. You simply can't do that. I mean, and the people can't trust us. And we did exactly the same with the protocol in February. The DUP said they'd solved the problem with the protocol, and now they admit they haven't. And when you start to be dishonest with the people on such major issues, then public confidence in the political process disappears.
Sammy Wilson said the following in his interview with Crawley. He said, we weren't lying to the public. The party had an official position. Individuals within the party, and I was one of them, he said, took opportunities where they were to try and get intelligence, which you could feed back so that people were in a position to know whether or not there was business to be done. Well, who was he feeding it back to?
Well, we don't know, and that intelligence, those meetings were with Martin McGuinness, and you can't get much more senior than that at the time. So therefore, but that doesn't square with the public comment of no contact. Now, had they said, no, there's no negotiations, but we're having informal briefing sessions in Dr. Good's home to see if there's a basis for negotiations. Well, that's a different thing. But we were told absolutely no contact. Indeed, we were instructed to Stormont not even to speak to Sinn Féin MLAs at Stormont, either privately or publicly, because of this policy of no contact with Sinn Féin. So therefore, how does that square with the fact that they're sitting in the front room of Dr. Good's parlour saying, discussing the framework for negotiations? That just doesn't tally. That is untrue, Stephen. And unfortunately, I have many, many other examples have emerged since of untruths being told to backbenchers. And I really, really have lost all confidence in the DUP. I've lost it years ago.
Well, you were a minister in it.
Yes,
so you,
I was.
You liked the party when you had the ministerial car, Jim, didn't you? You didn't have any problems with the methods, the ways of working of your party when you're in your wee ministerial car.
Because I was totally unaware of what had been going on behind the scenes. I think my attitude would have been totally different had I realised we were being deceived. And let's be honest about it, Stephen. We sat in that room every Monday morning at 10 o'clock at Stormont in room 135, and we were told, frankly, we were told untruths. Because this question emerged, this was the major issue between 2003 and 2007. What contact was there, or should there be, with Sinn Féin? And the MLAs at one stage, there were, I think, 35 of us there, were told no contact, period. Now, that's the problem I have. Not that there was formal talks.
But do you really think that when those negotiations did happen, and it was public that they were happening, do you really think that those talks came from nowhere?
With hindsight, Stephen, no. I think quite clearly when you look back, you realise that things moved so rapidly in 2007, it was impossible that the first meeting, which was told was a Saturday in March,
had occurred.
Well, what
were you told when it was announced?
We were told that there had been successful negotiations with Sinn Féin, and indeed they'd even agreed who was going to be a minister for which department. It moved remarkably fast, but again, we were told at the highest level, that that was the first contact with Sinn Féin. That's the problem. That's the problem I have. And they come to us privately and said, well, look, to be honest, we had sort of prior negotiations involving Sammy, Jeffrey and Timothy. Well, we would have not been too happy, but we would have maybe accepted it. But it's this blanket, pure than a diamond, we didn't do it line that really quite annoys me now and annoys a lot of other DUP people who are still in the party. Because what do you trust? Well, you know, and other assurances that were given, what actually happen?
Well, this is why, Jim, I'm asking Gavin Robinson as the new leader, new generation, new leader within the DUP, his view on what happened is important because it would dictate the expectations about his party and how his party communicates, not just internally with other people in the DUP, but ultimately how his party under his leadership deals and communicates with the public. This is not an old story. It's about what does Gavin Robinson, what's his view on how the party behaved during that time and what the party said to the public. Would Gavin Robinson communicate with the public like this had he been in charge then?
Well, to be fair to Gavin, Gavin at this stage had just got involved in the party and become a councillor. He never was at Stormont and he probably would never be in a position to have known what was going on.
No, you're misinterpreting. What I'm saying is, what's Gavin Robinson's, not his fault back then, but his current opinion on what happened back then? In other words, would he allow it to happen now within his party?
Yep.
Would he allow the public to be told something like this now, like it was?
Well, he did, Stephen, because in February we were given an assurance by Jeffrey Donaldson that the whole protocol issue had been solved. Now, Gavin has been man enough to come forward and say that simply wasn't true. We were sold a pup by Jeffrey. But Gavin now needs to come forward and say, and apologise to those who were relentlessly attacked by the party, and to make it very clear that the DUP will be honest with the people from the future. The slogan that we fought the 2007 election was, the Unionist Party you can trust. Really? How hollow does that statement ring now? That we can trust us to tell it as it is, or you can trust the DUP to tell it as it is. Gavin needs to come clean, apologise for the damage done, and make it absolutely clear he will not tolerate this type of behaviour in the future.
Okay, Jim Wells, thank you very much indeed. 03030 80 55 55. Next, staff at Forestside are up in arms after new parking charges have been imposed on them at Forestside Shopping Centre. They say it will lead, some of them say it will lead to workers on minimum wage struggling to make work pay. Tonya got in touch with us. Tonya works in Forestside Shopping Centre and she contacted the Nolan Show about these new charges being introduced. She told me what's happening.
Well, Stephen, last week we got a notification that as from the 4th of November, we as staff would be expected to pay £5 a day for the privilege of parking somewhere where we've parked in for a long time. This is very disappointing because the majority of people in Forestside are on minimum wage, and that will in effect mean that somebody who's working full time will be paying £25 a week in car parking, and that will be like £100 a month pay cut, which is very difficult. It was very, very disappointing, and we really just don't know what to do. So we thought of petitions, and somebody mentioned yourself, and because you have the voice, and I decided that rather than do nothing, that it was the only decent thing I could do.
And look, where have you parked up until this?
So we haven't. We have a designated parking area, which is the two-storey building or two-storey car parking opposite the front of Marks and Spencer's. And I've worked there for 3 years, and up until about a year ago, it was free. You had to pay park in that area, but it was free. And then when the building was bought over, we were then told that it was £1.50 a day, which again, you know, not everybody has extra money in their pay to pay for something that they were getting for free. And then last week we got the notification to say that as from the 4th of November, this would be rising to £5 a day.
And have you appealed to the new owners not to do it?
I'm not in management, Stephen, but I know that the managers of several of the units, you know, will be meeting and doing this. But I just felt that so many of the staff were distressed. People who have had, you know, partners who have had young babies who just don't have £100 a month, you know, leeway in their pay. And it was just when your name was mentioned, I thought about it over the weekend and I thought, I have to speak out here. And, you know, as far as I know, the managers will be talking to the owners. But I think, realistically, I think the reason why £5 a day has been decided is to put staff off from, you know, using the car parking spaces so that it is free for customers.
So where do you think they think you're going to park, or how are you going to get to work?
From my personal situation, the option that I have is getting a bus into town and then out again to Forestside, or parking near residential areas. And I know personally I wouldn't like people parking outside my house in vast numbers, but those are the two options I have, because I'm not going to be paying £5 a day. I just feel it's totally unfair. I'm in a fortunate position where I could afford it, but I know that a lot of my colleagues within that centre can't. So we just
Jobs, are they?
Well, that's the option. And I mean, we find it very difficult in Forestside to get staff, because it is, most of them are minimum wage jobs. So now at interview, they're going to have to be told, well, if you drive a car, there will be a parking fee. You know, and not everybody. Forestside is quite a difficult place to get to on a bus, you know, other than from the centre of Belfast. I live in East Belfast, and there's just no way of me getting a bus unless I go into Belfast and out again. So we just don't know what to do, Stephen. And that's why we thought we would...
In very, very shortly.
On the 4th of November.
Doesn't it? So you're really appealing... At the end of the day, you're really appealing to Michael Herbert, aren't you? He's the new owner.
Yes, I am. But you have the voice. I don't, unfortunately.
He's the new owner of the Forestside complex. And you're saying, as a team of people working in Forestside, is there anything he could do? And for some people, a fiver a day, 25 quid a week, is nothing. And to other people, it's a difference from being able to heat their homes this winter.
Totally. I mean, I know of people who wouldn't have £100 to spend on parking. And it's really them I'm talking on behalf of. It's just not fair. I totally understand that, you know, with the restaurants coming in, which unfortunately have taken away a lot of the car parking, that they're in a situation where they need to provide parking for the public. But I think, you know, shooting the staff like this is just, it's just not fair.
Well, look, leave it with us.
Okay, Stephen.
Leave it with us and we'll get in touch and we'll be in touch back with you. Is that all right?
I really appreciate that, Stephen. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, look, we had been in touch with Forestside about this. They said no one was available for comment. I'm just saying within the last few seconds, because this story, we recorded that interview yesterday. We didn't have time to broadcast it yesterday. I'm just saying within the last few seconds that the Belfast Telegraph, who also ran this story on the front page of their paper this morning, are now reporting that Forestside have U-turned on these charges. That's the Belfast Telegraph's reporting. We'll try to get some clarity around this ourselves, because when we went to Forestside yesterday, and that would have been yesterday, I did that interview about 10:30 yesterday morning. So we would have gone to Forestside after that. They were saying no comment between yesterday morning and now. They've U-turned, according to the Belfast Telegraph. Michael's in Belfast. Morning, Michael.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, sir.
I am living in the neighbourhood 31 years this August, and there's never been a problem with parking with the old Supermac and now Forestside. But since the ownership of Leslie Forestside has taken over, what we're finding is all over the junction...
Can you come off speakerphone for me?
I'm not on speakerphone.
We are very distant.
Oh, sorry, I'll speak louder. So basically, all around Church Road, Sainsbury's Road, Galwally Avenue, they've had to put in double yellow lines because people are parking all over the place, employees or customers who don't want to go in and face the the hassle of trying to navigate through the parking with all, you know, busy periods. So we're finding 50, 60, 70 cars all parked around the junctions of the neighbouring streets opposite Forestside, which in itself creates problems because getting out in the morning can be difficult with rush hour traffic and then people parking at the light so you can't get out makes it even more difficult.
The person that's bought, the person behind the company who has bought Forestside, a guy called Michael Herbert. Yes. And if you look, I've never met him. I don't know him. I'm not a friend of his. But if you look throughout Northern Ireland, as to the many, many projects that he seems to be behind, someone was saying to me the other day that this guy's a visionary, that this guy actually can... You know, the amount of employment that he's creating, the amount of visionary projects that he's ahead of the curve on, it would be really, really interesting. I would love to meet him, sit down, have a chat with him, because he's creating a lot of employment, isn't he, Michael? And I'm just throwing that into the mix of look, here's a problem with staff and with parking. But yeah, this is
if you bring in restaurants into the mix. I live opposite, so I generally cycle to go into Forestside because it's easier to cycle in, and so I don't try and drive in, especially at busy periods. But if you're going to bring in restaurants, and Paula Bradshaw, I just emailed her yesterday. Yeah.
Michael, the sound's terrible, so I'm going to we'll see if we can get it fixed. Let's see if we can get an update from the staff member who we recorded that interview with yesterday. Tonya, you're back with us. What can you tell us, Tonya?
Stephen, I'm just delighted that you ran with the story this morning, and I believe the Belfast Telegraph. Have you had any news or updates?
Well, the Belfast Telegraph, Margaret Canning and Andrew Madden are reporting at 10:14 this morning, so 13 minutes ago, they sent out a tweet which said a South Belfast shopping centre has U-turned on a decision to hike staff parking fees from £1.50 to £5 a day.
Oh, Stephen, I'm just delighted about that. I really am. I can't explain to you how, just for everybody's sake, it will just lift everybody. It really will. Thank you so much for running with the story. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. And I'm sorry we didn't get it on air yesterday. As you know, we recorded it straight after the programme yesterday. Look, many people listening to this have to pay parking themselves when they go to work.
Of course.
Why should you be not pay a lot of parking differently to others?
I think one of the problems is, Stephen, that for so long, when we took the jobs, that parking came as free, and therefore it wasn't part of the, you know, terms and conditions. We knew what we were going to earn, and we knew that, you know, there was no parking in that. And then to have that imposed on us, I think a lot of people find that very difficult. Even the £1.50, you know, for some people that still was, you know, money that they just didn't have at the end of the month to allocate to parking because they'd never had to before. And it is a difficult place to get to. You know, it's different if you're in Belfast there, you know, you've got the glider and everything. But just Forestside is a wee bit positioned where it is more difficult to get to. But honestly, I think that will just lift every staff member's heart today. And I just can't thank you enough for running with the story. I really can't. Your team have been brilliant too.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much indeed.
Right.
I just want to get our clarity around what Forestside are not doing, because what we've had here at the Nolan Show yesterday is no one is available to comment. Telegraph running a different story in the last 13 minutes. We'll bring you an update tomorrow. And Tonya, thank you very much for bringing your story to the Nolan Show. We really appreciate it. And if you've got a story, nolan@bbc.co.uk. So, the Chancellor will stand up in 2 hours' time now and deliver the budget for all of us. I'm sure we'll be covering that in the morning and other stories on the biggest show in the country. Have a good day.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.